Lieber and Stoller, even if you don't know their names, you surely know their body of work. The songwriting duo is behind hits by Elvis Presley, Benny King, Johnny Cash, and other giants of R&B, country, and early rock and roll. The Bremen Museum and Theatrical Outfit are honoring their legacy in a show called Baby, That's Rock and Roll, the Lieber-Stoller Era. We spoke with the men behind the concert tribute, Adam Kotlin, the artistic director of Flying Carpet Theater, and Greg Sudemeyer, the music director and producer of Atlanta Audible. They told us how two young Jewish boys from Brooklyn came to help define rock and roll as we know it.
Take out the papers and the trash, or you don't get no spending cash.
For people who don't know Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller from their songwriting credits, who were they?
Oh, my gosh. Well, everybody knows Poison Ivy and Yakety Yak and help me out, Adam.
Jailhouse
oh,
Rock.
Gosh, yes.
Hound Dog.
Hound Dog.
Oh, yeah.
Does it get any more iconic?
Stand By Me.
Absolutely. And you know, what's amazing is to hear wonderful singers like Smokey Robinson say that they were hearing this music and they just automatically assumed it was from Black writers.
One of the things that we'll certainly talk a lot about in the upcoming concert is the way that Lieber and Stoller were so heavily influenced by Black musicians. Stoller, though he grew up in a family that prized classical music and insisted that he take classical music lessons, at a certain point, his mom sent him to a leftist camp in New Jersey where he heard Boogie Woogie for the first time.
And, imagine that.
Yes. And he was so intoxicated by the boogie-woogie sound that he talked his parents into getting him lessons with the preeminent stride pianist of the day. So he grew up in Sunnyside, Queens, and they took the train out to Jamaica where he got these lessons, and it sort of changed the arc of his life.
Yep.
And Jerry Lieber grew up in Baltimore, and his father died young, and he had to work delivering coal and kerosene, and they lived right by a Black neighborhood. And when he was delivering coal and kerosene, starting at six, he started to hear doo-wop on the street corners and boogie-woogie coming out of the windows, and he was enthralled musically. And he also felt that he would get beat up in the white neighborhoods mm-hmm. when he was delivering stuff because of anti-Semitics kind of treatment, slurs were being thrown at him. In the Black neighborhoods, he never had a problem, so he developed this affinity for Black culture. And by the time the two met, their bonding point was R&B, boogie-woogie.
How did they meet?
So that's a fun story, actually. Lieber was working at a record store. They're young now. They're living in California. Their families had to move out to L.A. for economic reasons. And Lieber's working at a record store, and he's writing blues songs all of the time, and he's handing them out to anybody who will come and give him the time of day. And an A&R person from a record company said, "Hey, these are pretty good. I need some lead sheets, some sheet music."
And he couldn't do it.
He couldn't write. His writing partner, he thought, "Well, I'll just go and talk to my writing partner." And just then, literally that week, his partner had to quit because of a death in his family. So he goes into crisis, and as an afterthought, the old partner hands him a crumpled piece of paper and says, "You might as well call this guy. I heard him play last week. He's pretty good." So at age 16, he calls up Stoller and says, "Hey, you want to write music with me?" Stoller says, "Oh, man, I don't think I can. I don't want to. Let me come over and try and talk you into it." So he heads – they lived in a similar neighborhood. He heads over. He stands at the door. The door opens up, and Stoller won't even let him in because his point of view is, "I'm too cool for this guy." Meanwhile, Jerry Lieber's point of view is he looks at Mike Stoller, who's wearing a beret and has a goatee, and he says, "Oh, no, a bebopper, one of those guys." So they're both – yeah, exactly. They both have this skepticism. But by the time they make it to the piano, and realize that they share this love of the blues.
Connected.
Yeah, totally connected. 40 years, 50 years of writing.
And I was going to say that that also marks probably one of the essences of their relationship and why they were so successful is because they allowed themselves to grow. They challenged their own snobbery. Even Mike Stoller says, yeah, I was a snob. And this changed me.
You can't really say anybody invented rock and roll, but they're certainly in the vanguard of folks who helped bring rock and roll to the center of culture in the 50s.
Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come.
So Kansas City, that song, Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come, I think they wrote when they were 19 years old. And they would crank these out in like 10, 15 minutes. That was their writing style. And by 1953, I think, Kansas City was a national hit. And when they started, they were writing for these small labels in California that were largely black performers, black musicians. And so they thought they were writing straight blues for blues musicians. And then the story kind of takes a new twist when a couple of years later, Elvis covers one of the songs that they'd written for a woman named Big Mama Thornton.
Yeah, Hound Dog. That's the Hound Dog story.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
This is, again, the challenge of snobbery is they actually hated Elvis's version when they heard it because they'd recorded it at first with Big Mama Thornton, and they got really used to that feel.
Well, they said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie.
And then they heard Elvis's version, and they didn't like the tempo. They didn't like this and that. But they realized, wait a minute, this is selling like crazy. This is attracting an audience we wouldn't have gotten any other way.
So they felt Elvis wasn't authentic.
I think actually they ended up having kind of a decade run with Elvis.
Yeah.
I didn't say it didn't sell.
but they were very careful to say that they bonded with Elvis and they liked Elvis and they shared, like Elvis as white guys, an encyclopedic knowledge of the blues. So when they got together... Yeah.
Elvis had that.
Elvis knew his stuff.
Absolutely.
I think their point of view wasn't so much that they didn't think Elvis was a good musician. I think at that time, it was specifically about Hound Dog. They felt that they wrote it as a blues number for a woman talking about kind of a cad who was roaming around. And so to have a guy singing it, not as a straight blues, and talking about a rabbit.
Changed the lyric.
Which they never even put in the song.
Elvis wrote that.
Yeah, they spent a little bit of time looking at each other saying, this isn't the song we wrote.
I know that he had immense respect for black music. He used to go to black churches.
That's correct.
But the reality was, he was made a star.
Right.
Chuck Berry wasn't.
That's correct.
And he stood on the shoulders of a lot of black musicians who deserved the kind of marketing that
Elvis
that he
enjoyed
was given.
The inherent privilege of the time.
No question. And Lieber and Stoller knew that. In fact, they talk about how they understood that white kids of the day were more prone to like something put out by a white musician.
We're talking 1950s.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
They got it. They said, look, from our point of view, the stuff we're attracted to, the stuff we want to write, is closer to R&B. And all of the innovators in R&B, for the most part, are black. They looked up, for example, to Ray Charles and thought, you know, he was just an idol to them. And the list goes on and on. But they also, you know, had to acknowledge that they were kind of lucky to be at the right place at the right time when rock and roll popped like that and made the jump from R&B into something a little more mainstream. And they were part of that. And they also began to acknowledge also that they weren't writing straight R&B anymore. They were taking some of their own innovations and sort of helping to mainstream a slightly different sound. They were branching off from R&B.
Do Mike's and Jerry's Jewish religion, their culture, their Jewish culture and upbringing, does that inform their music?
Absolutely.
How so?
They came from their vantage point of their culture being very similar to the Black experience. And this is something we talked about with the Harold Arlen as well because of his connection in that sense. And it's the essence of both the pain of the subject matter that they were writing about and also the joy of the styles of music that they were – the genre they were writing in. And they combined that, and the pain of the cultures were very connected, which is why the Black and the Jewish culture have coexisted very nicely for a long time.
Because it's all from the soul.
That's the point, the music is universal. And one of the brilliant things about Lieber and Stoller is they could tell stories. They told stories in their music that connected to the everyday person and a family experience. And they could nail that. I love the story about when I guess Jerry Lieber was literally yelling at Mike Stoller going, "Hey, take out the papers in the trash." And Mike Stoller thought he was writing a song. He says,
"Or you won't get no spending cash."
That's exactly right. And they, bammo, there's Yakety Yak. And they just bounced off each other. But they used their experience that related to everybody else's experience, no matter what culture there was.
In essence, what is it about their songwriting that you think accounts for the music's enduring popularity? Maybe we could say immortality.
First of all, I think it's the connection to the blues. I mean, they used the Black experience and the genre of blues, which goes to the heart immediately because it came from the heart when it was first created, which turned into Dixieland jazz and the whole birth of the American art form. So they used that as their structure, essentially. It was basically all blues-oriented kind of things. But then again, their knack for story and really writing things that connected everybody. It just runs all the way through. Think of Stand By Me. I mean, here I am in New Orleans just last month, and one of the street musicians starts playing Stand By Me, right, on the street. And there was really a row of homeless people that were on the other side of the street, and they all stood up and held hands and sang along. And this is the Lieber and Stoller Stand By Me, because it means so much to so many people. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand. Stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand. Stand by me. Stand by me. They also had a knack for making collaborator songs better. They weren't, they themselves, just the two of them, had tremendous success writing songs and then having other people record them. But over time, they were producers and record label owners, and eventually lots of people were coming through their door and working with them. So Benny King, who is the one of the principal songwriters of Stand By Me, came in with a tune, but that amazing bass line, that's Mike Stoller's idea. The structure, the lyrics, right,
that's partially Jerry Lieber.
Right.
Same deal with, you know, the country song Johnny Cash, June Carter Jackson? So that was written initially by a friend of Jerry Lieber's who had just come out of Yale School of Drama and was inspired by Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf to write a song about marital distress. And he hands it to Jerry Lieber, who says, no, you got this all wrong. Jerry Lieber had such a brilliant mind for song structure and song lyrical structure. He pulled that lyric, "We Got Married in a Fever."
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout.
Which is at the tail end of the song that the guy originally wrote. He said, you got to put that as the first line. And he helped them restructure it. And there's story after story of their ability to know how a song is listened to, what makes it compelling, what makes it unfold over time.
That's called the art of the hook.
Look out, Jackson Town.
We'll go on down to Jackson. Go ahead and wreck your hell. Go play your hand, you big talking man. Make a big fool of yourself. Yeah, go to...
I remember I was in high school when the song "Is That All There Is" was recorded. Peggy Lee made it a hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I was transfixed by that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is.
They were deep in their collaboration with Peggy Lee when they wrote that. One of their I think they were thinking more in terms of what are songs that she can put over the stratosphere that she will interpret, and that they felt for her, she had lived through so much, and they knew that she would be able to interpret a song like that. And they talk about how she walked into the studio that day and said, "I'll give you three," but once she started singing it, she ended up doing something in the neighborhood of 47 takes.
Mm-hmm.
And they claim, how could you ever prove this? They claim that take number 46 was the most magical, unbelievable, soul-stirring thing that had ever happened, and the recording engineer forgot to press record. So they used take 47, which Stoller says was like 95% as good, but he always wonders what would have happened if the recording engineer hadn't forgotten to press play on it.
It's hard to imagine any more world weariness than she conveyed in that.
They said that take that they lost was like looking into the blazing sun of somebody's soul. But hey. Who knows?
Is that all there is? Is that all there is?
Tell us what the audience at the Bremen will get to experience. What will be the format of this show?
A little bit of talk and a lot of rock.
infotainment.
Yeah, it's about 35 minutes of concert with four amazing Atlanta musical theater performers and singers, along with a four-person rock quartet.
Yeah, it's a 4-on-4, and some of the best singers in Atlanta you'll hear. I mean, really, they are quite amazing.
And then what we do is we set up the songs with a little bit of context, some anecdotes, and then launch into the song. So it has the feel a little bit of imagine one of those A&E biography shows that we actually, instead of just seeing little snippets, you intersperse with an amazing performance of the full song. And then you heard a little bit more about the artist's life or collaboration, and then a wham-bam medley with some dance. And
it's so cool because you walk away going, I know more about why this affects me and why it affected them at that time. It's a great thing to be able to connect the dots.
I also, similarly with the Arlen piece, I feel with this material, talking about just a few artists' contribution to rock and roll history ends up telling this larger story about American culture and the way in which it's such a story of different groups coming together and collaborating. Sometimes there's tension, as you alluded to. Sometimes it's harmonious, but the output, at the risk of sounding like a cliche, is the result of this melting pot. So I think that we're telling the story of Lieber and Stoller, but in a larger sense, we're also getting at the story of rock and roll, which is the story of lots of parts of American culture.
Walking through a party in the county jail. The prison band was there, they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard this knocked out jailbird sing that rock.
That was Adam Copland and Greg Sudermeyer. Baby, that is rock and roll. The Lieber-Stoller era, a Molly Blank concert, takes place for one night only at the Bremen Museum, Sunday, March 19th. This is City Lights on WABE Atlanta.